Okay, hi everyone. Sorry we were late. We were working out a few technical difficulties. Hello everyone in the US, Israel, Palestine, and other places in the world. My name is Ron Skolnick. I organize the Conversations with Israel and Palestine series for Partners for Progressive Israel. Conversations with Israel and Palestine is a series of informational webinars that bring voices from Israel and Palestine to an American and an international audience. The series is designed to provide an important link between progressives in the Middle East and those outside the region. And I'd like to welcome you to the latest installment in that series, which is called Biden, Trump, Israel, and Palestine. Before I hand it over to today's discussion moderator, Hillel Schenker, let me note that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit organization dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors and believes in the need to ensure civil rights, equality and social justice for all of Israel's inhabitants. Partners seeks to deepen Americans' understanding of Israel's complexities so that they can better advocate for a progressive Israeli future. Now, if you like Partners programming and want more like it, think about visiting our website at progressiveisrael.org and making a contribution so that we can continue delivering programming like this for free. Let me now introduce today's moderator, who will be doing double duty as a moderator slash panelist, and that is Hillel Schenker. Hillel is the co-editor of the Palestine-Israel Journal, which is a Jerusalem-based English-language quarterly whose goal is to explore and discuss all the core issues on the Israeli-Palestinian agenda. Previously, Hillel served for 13 years as an editor of New Outlook, an Israeli Peace Monthly founded in the spirit of Martin Buber's philosophy of dialogue. New Outlook served as a catalyst for dialogue and some important initiatives for peace. Hillel is also a member of the Policy Working Group, which works within the international community to promote a two-state solution. One other thing, Hillel, and this is very germane to our topic today, also served in the past as chair of Democrats Abroad Israel, the Israeli branch of the Democratic Party, from 2012 to 2016. He was born in New York on an urban kibbutz. He was later a member of Kibbutz Barkai in Israel for 13 years, and he now lives in Tel Aviv. So, with no further ado, take it away, Hillel, and have a fascinating conversation.
Okay, thank you, Ron, and I hope everybody hears me. We have some slight technical problems. My mic on the computer wasn't working, so that's why I'm using this phone. We'll be now having a discussion for about 40 minutes in which I and the panelists will be making comments, and afterwards, the audience will have a chance to ask questions for 20 minutes. So we encourage you to type in questions either in the chat or in the Q&A box. So now, actually, I was supposed to introduce the two panelists, but Ron already did that. And I would like to start by reading something that appeared in Haaretz today, which I think is very relevant to our discussion. There was an article on the op-ed page called Mourning Saeb Erekat. As we all know, Saeb Erekat, the chief negotiator of the Palestinians passed away just 2 days ago. And there was an article signed, a joint article by Martin Indyk, Dan Kurtzer, Rob Mali, Aaron, David Miller, Dennis Ross, all of the American, many of the Americans who were very involved over the past few administrations before the Trump administration in trying to facilitate an Israeli-Palestinian resolution of the conflict. And I'd just like to quote what they said at the end. "We mark Saeb's passing, knowing full well that prospects for an enduring peace between Israelis and Palestinians may seem now like a distant dream. Having worked on this issue for years, we have no illusions, and neither did Saeb. But he never abandoned hope that with leadership, courage, and determination, peace remained possible. Saeb Erekat never gave up hope, and to honor him, neither should we." Saeb, unfortunately, did not live to see the declaration of Biden's victory over Trump. And this is where we are today. We have Of course, we're calling this discussion with a very catchy title of Biden, Trump, Israel, Palestine. And so to begin commenting, initial responses, Jessica, please, what are you feeling today?
Well, I think everyone feels, anyone who cares about the future, first of all, of the United States feels a huge sense of relief with the victory of Biden-Harris. You know, we're talking here about the implications for Israel-Palestine, but of course, first and foremost, it's a victory for the United States and the welfare of the population there. But if we look globally, you know, the rise of Trump strengthened autocratic tendencies around the world. That's true for our government. And, you know, it's enough to see the way that Prime Minister Netanyahu has evolved over these past 4 years. The rhetoric that he uses, you know, his attitude toward rule of law institutions, it's a pattern that we see, I think, repeated around the world of these sort of, you know, democratic autocrats that have been emboldened by President Trump. So first of all, the hope is that there will be some domino effect that those autocrats and autocratic tendencies will fall with the fall of President Trump. And specifically in terms of policies here, I mean, I think no one has wild optimism about what a Biden administration can do here. There's no, if there is any, then I will disabuse you of that notion. The Biden administration is not going to end the Israeli occupation. The Biden administration is not going to bring about a two-state solution. What the Biden administration can and should do is implement a policy of promoting human rights. I mean, here and around the world. This is possible, this is doable, and this is super important to right now, you know, from day one, insist that all allies of the United States respect human rights, and that includes Israel. I mean, there are some things that can be done to lay the groundwork for a diplomatic process, but the best way that we can all use all of our resources and that a Biden administration can use its capital here is to be ensuring that Israel respects human rights vis-a-vis the Palestinians.
Okay, thank you, Jessica. Jonathan, what are you feeling and what are your thoughts?
Well, I think I have to say that the results of these elections were both good news and bad news for anybody interested in Israel and Palestine. The good news, of course, is that Trump is gone. He was a crazy outlier in the total support he gave to the most extreme right-wing factions in Israel. Even their fantasies, including the fantasies of getting reparations and forcing Palestinians to abandon everything from the right of return to Jerusalem to equality to anything, he was there with them. No matter what they wanted, they would get, and they would get even a little bit more of that. So, yes, it was good news that he is gone. The bad news is that both Biden and Kamala Harris are really nothing but a return to the status quo, probably even more establishment view of AIPAC, verbal support for two-state solution without anything concrete, opposition to BDS, opposition to any form of sanctions, opposition to any form of pressure on Israel, allowing the status quo to continue. More importantly, they return to a situation, to a status quo, that is in severe crisis. Crisis because Israel has moved so far to the right that more than 70% of them wanted Trump over Biden. So Israel is very much in the right-wing mode. the Palestinians have largely given up much faith in their own leadership. The Palestinian Authority today is in a crisis of trust. Nobody really trusts them to advance Palestinian interests. They are seen as being really doing the work of the occupation as a subcontractor to keep the population down, with no vision, with no fight in them, with no willingness to resist, just to do the work of the occupation. So you have Israel right wing, no faith and trust in the PA, and the situation on the ground where the idea, the very idea of a two-state solution has pretty much collapsed on the ground. Not because people didn't believe in it, but because it's no longer doable. The facts on the ground with 700,000-800,000 Israeli settlers in the occupied territories that were slated to be a Palestinian state, pretty much entrenched, not only with the infrastructure, but with the laws, the administration, the psychological integration into Israel. It is now no longer possible to really think about a genuine Palestinian state in the 67 area. But nobody is coming up with alternatives. Nobody is talking about what does it mean to live within one state where both Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews can coexist together with any semblance of a normalcy, any semblance of equality, any semblance of really living in the 21st or even the 20th century anymore. That conversation is almost taboo. And I think the left and the progressives are slowly falling into the situation where they are only apologists for trying to slightly improve the status quo rather than come up with any new vision. So this is the bad news, that the situation really is in crisis and crisis mode, and that there is very little hope that Biden, Harris are going to provide any leadership to get out of it. In fact, the United States, as has been, is part of the problem and has not been part of the solution so far. With that, I think my 5 minutes are up.
Okay, let's for a moment look back happily at Trump, assuming we're looking back at the end of his regime. How much damage has he done? After all, when you think of he announced that he was moving the embassy to Jerusalem, but the fact is that all he did is put up a sign, it's symbolic, and all of the embassy work is still being done in Tel Aviv. He announced that he recognized Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights, and even there's an announcement that there will be a Trump village established in his honor, and all it is a sign. In other words, and he came out with this absurd plan, Peace for Prosperity, which meanwhile has not gone anywhere. Has he done irreparable damage? And what can be done to undo what he did? Jessica.
Well, he has definitely done damage. I think it's a good question. What can be undone and what, you know, what is a new reality that we have to accommodate? You know, for the past 4 years, there is no address in terms of the U.S. State Department, the diplomatic representatives here for human rights concerns. You know, no leadership also in terms of the role that the United States used to play in responding to rounds of violence, negotiating between the different parties in order to, you know, reduce tension, avert the worst implications. And that has created a vacuum that in some ways others have filled in. I mean, Egypt that stepped in several times to negotiate between the parties to halt rounds of violence. To some extent, Europe has stepped in to be trying to avert the worst of settlement expansion, demolition of Palestinian homes. So yes, the United States could reassert the positive roles that it played pre-Trump. But as you said, the new reality, I mean, you know, you can debate what is the implication. Also, the symbolic has implication. Is the Biden administration going to formally return the embassy to Tel Aviv? And how much does that matter? I mean, as you say, the substance maybe is not different in terms of the trust of Palestinians in the ability of the United States to play that role. I think the symbolism is important, but I would let Jonathan talk about that. And the normalization deals with the Gulf have also created a new reality that it is irrelevant whether, you know, we thought it was a good or a positive development. I mean, what that means, you know, we have to take that as fact and move forward. That will not be undone. And the arms deals that go along with that, what that means for, you know, a new sort of arms race in this region, those are all momentum that will not be reversed.
Yes, Jonathan, how do you see the impact of Trump?
Well, number one, he really revealed the weakness of the Arab side and of the Palestinian side and of the process that was in place. Part of what he did that was really, really bad was really he wrecked the basis of international law and the international discourse that was taking place. He showed that it was irrelevant. That when push comes to shove, Israel, with the support of the United States, can get away with pretty much whatever they want to get away with. Of course, there's some part of me which says that's awful, that's terrible, but another part that says, let's face the reality. That is the truth. The United States is not willing to really abide by international law or to force Israel to abide by international law. The Arabs or the Palestinians cannot depend on the Arab world as long as it is ruled by autocrats who are beholden to the United States and maybe even to Israel. That in fact, the principles of international law, human rights, justice, etc., do not necessarily automatically translate into justice on the ground. That we really have to fight for any modicum of laws. And so, in a sense, I hate to say that he did us a favor, but he certainly took away the mask that many of us were hiding behind and says, this is the stark reality. And now we really have to step up. And it's not enough to just put the mask back on. Basically, Biden and Kamala Harris put the mask back on. They still talk about two states. They will still make some noises every time Israel expands its settlements, but they will not. They will start giving us few crumbs on the table. They'll start refunding UNRWA. They'll start giving some aid to Palestinian hospitals, for example. They may or may not make us pay a price before they will open a new the PLO office again or the Palestinian office again, but they will continue to pressure us not to go to the International Criminal Court. They will continue to oppose BDS. They will continue to support the PA as a subcontractor to Israeli occupation and will resist any genuine work for justice.
Yeah. let's look a little internally, because obviously one of the major factors is what's going to happen in Israeli and in Palestinian society in order to respond to what has happened in the United States. For example, Jessica, one of the things that we've been hearing at all of the recent demonstrations is if it could happen in the United States, the karov etzlenu, maybe it can happen here too. And we see every week now, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of people out there demonstrating against Netanyahu. Do you see any possibility of internal change within Israeli society which can take advantage of this new reality of Trump being gone?
Well, of course, we all hope so. I mean, I think there is, as I said, a domino effect of the way that Trump emboldened autocratic tendencies, both, you know, leadership as well as rhetoric, as well as what is considered acceptable in terms of the conduct of leadership. The fact that that has been rejected by the American people is, you know, a beacon to all the rest of us. But there's no promise. I mean, that it's on us. And the Israeli left has to, there is some potential for momentum if we seize it and capitalize on it. And, you know, you're right, that we all are demonstrating every week at Balfour outside of the Prime Minister's house. The residents and around the country, I think hundreds of thousands is a little overly optimistic in terms of the strength of our numbers, but certainly there is, a really feisty and in some ways new energy among those demonstrators that it's now, months that have been demonstrating week after week after week, young people who had not been involved before. So, we all hope that this is like a new wind in our sails to be able to, also bring about political change here. I mean, of course, the fact that Netanyahu enjoyed such a close relationship with Trump, that will be removed also has policy implications. The fact that the right wing knew that it could get away with anything, that there were no, I mean, it's not only Trump who is leaving, right? I mean, Ambassador Friedman, maybe more of a hardcore settlement activist than Netanyahu, certainly, or, any of the settler leadership. You had an incredible quote of, sometimes it's even hard, who is Israel's ambassador to the U.S. and who is the U.S. ambassador to Israel? The roles change. But Israel's ambassador to the U.S. that said often with the Trump administration, the dynamic was not we asked and they gave it to us. They gave us things we didn't even ask for. So, in terms of settlement expansion, recognition of the legitimacy of settlements, a green light for annexation, all of those things, that maybe, gifts that maybe even Netanyahu did not want. So the fact that that is no longer the case, the fact that there will be, there is the substance and there is the messaging. And I think we can't dismiss even the rhetoric, the fact that, lip service also has value, that the reassertion of rule of law, international norms, democratic principles. I mean, I understand what Jonathan is saying, that there is some fig leaf, that if you are going to condemn settlement expansion, but there is no accountability and no repercussions, in some ways it's refreshing not even to bother with that condemnation. On the other hand, the fact that, that certain red lines will be drawn again, I think will be helpful also for the internal. I mean, this whole rhetoric of, let's say fake news that has seeped into the Israeli conversation as well. The the style of Israeli politicians that now are mimicking, you know, the ugliest trends of, you know, the style of the Trump administration. The fact that all of that will be gone, I think, you know, I end with what I started from. There's an opportunity for the Israeli left if we seize it, if we build on it. But there is no promise that the fact that the U.S. public got rid of Trump means that we will be able to get rid of Netanyahu.
Jonathan, what about the situation in the Palestinian society? Mahmoud Abbas will soon be celebrating his 85th birthday. There is talk, has been talk about having elections, but we don't see yet that they are happening. There is talk about reconciliation. That also hasn't happened. Is there any sign of a possibility of change and initiative, new initiatives coming out of Palestinian society?
Well, I hope we'll have elections. Elections are always good. In fact, I even heard a rumor that Fatah and Hamas may be running a joint list for the elections if they have them, not so much because they are at reconciliation, but because they are both afraid of what the population would think, because the population is both upset with Hamas and with Fatah. The population wants genuine democracy, and they want change, and they're really, it's an amazing situation where there is a lot of lethargy, a lot of despair, but also a lot of potential, a lot of energy that can easily be tapped in the direction of progress for a solution. A tremendous amount of energy. You have a lot of people there who really want to see a peaceful solution, who are genuinely committed to a peaceful solution, who are way beyond their leaders in terms of their rhetoric and in terms of what they are speaking. But they have not been organized into either a political party or a movement or a charismatic leader, and they are really kept suppressed until they explode. And they will explode, for sure. And it may not be a violent explosion, but there will be an explosion, and there will be change, and everybody will turn back and say, oh, this is surprising. Nobody told us this was coming. I'm telling you, it's coming. There will be a major fundamental change in Palestinian politics, hopefully through the ballots and through elections, but there will be change. This kind of situation, we've been for half a century now living under military occupation. Just yesterday, there was a whole pile of new military orders that were issued. Nobody even paid any attention. The Israelis are governing each and every aspect of our lives without our having any input in it. They can arrest us, administrative detention. There's hundreds of people today in jail for no reason, no charges and no trial. Gaza is under siege, has been under siege for 13, 14 years now. Nobody can go in and out, no goods can come in and out, and it's totally forgotten, and it's not part of the political dialogue. It's not part of the progress. If you want peace, we have to start talking about Gaza and start talking to Hamas directly. If we don't do that, all this talk about two states and all this talk about peace is meaningless. So it is not necessary that we come up with the ultimate macro solution. There are so many things that we can do on the ground now immediately. Lifting the siege is one of them. Ending administrative detentions totally is another one. Holding elections is another one. Starting to talk about Palestinian development in Area C. Now, people are talking about Area C as if it's not part of the West Bank, as if it's part of Israel now. That's 60% of the West Bank that we can't even build in, that we can't even, plant trees in. 60% of the West Bank. And it's like not on anybody's radar. It's not part of the discussion. This is what I mean by we are in a situation of crisis. And people who are progressive, people who are leftist, people who still hold any kind of vision for peace, must start talking about these things concretely, rather than just discuss forever two state, one state, and ultimate solutions. There are concrete things that can be worked on now, immediately and directly.
Okay, I'd like to go back to the incoming Biden administration. Now, obviously, it's clear that the Middle East and Israel-Palestine will not be the first thing on their agenda, because the first thing they're going to have to deal with is COVID-19 and the state of the economy. But Biden also has always been very involved in international affairs. He was the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee. He also believes very much in a multilateral world, working together with allies, not just going alone, which creates an opening for other factors, for Europe, for the UN, for Russia even, and perhaps the Arab League, if they at all want to play a role, to be able to play a part in some new initiative. What should we, Israelis, Israeli civil society, Palestinian civil society, American civil society, and international civil society, what concretely should we be recommending to the Biden administration to do?
So the clear recommendation is to reassume leadership on human rights on the global stage. I mean, of course, there are a lot of other global priorities in terms of climate change. You know, that also is a pressing issue that needs to be addressed immediately. But in terms of, you know, human rights here, it's not unique. The neglect of human rights violations, or even the encouraging human rights violations, he is not unique here. That you see that around the globe in terms of the Trump administration, and then to be reasserting that the same standards apply everywhere, that all U.S. allies will be held accountable. I mean, from Saudi Arabia to Israel and other places. And I don't think as you said, let's say a diplomatic process for Israel-Palestine is not the first or second or third priority of the Biden administration. And I'm glad that's the case. We should not be wasting our time, any of us, pushing for negotiations at this point. As Jonathan said, there are things that can be done right now that do not depend on, you know, arguing about whether or not there's a partner and whether or not there's enough popular support among Palestinians or among Israelis. The, you know, current state of political leadership among the Palestinians as well as on the Israeli side, to put all of that aside and to be insisting Israel has to respect human rights the same way that every U.S. ally has to respect human rights. That message that has to come back and be central to U.S. foreign policy. You know, let's hope that that will be an easy lift in terms of, you know, the new State Department taking shape.
Okay. I think we can now begin going to the questions. I see a lot of questions in the chat area, and I hope I can read. I don't see necessarily the names of the people, but I will read out some of the questions. Here's one question says, a majority of the Israelis, at least among the settlers, supported Trump. Does it imply that there is no majority for a viable two-state solution?
You know, again, the current Israeli government says we will never dismantle any settlements. So, you know, it still is the case that, you know, in the polling where you say, do you want peace with the Palestinians, a majority says yes. Are you willing to, you know, what sort of boundaries of the state of Israel and the state of Palestine? There is some configuration that a majority of Israelis support the creation of some viable Palestinian state. To my mind, that's, again, not the conversation now. And I would also preempt, you know, in the questions, there are a lot of questions about one state. Maybe we should all switch now about one state, two state. Again, it is not worth our breath right now to be arguing. Certainly among American progressives, do we prefer one state or two state? It doesn't matter what you prefer. There is no movement among the Israeli population, neither for one state nor for two. There is no vision and strategy among the Palestinian leadership to be forcing us Israelis to be willing to engage with that. So in the absence of both of those things, I think it's not, you know, that's not the fight that we within progressives, you know, Israeli, Palestinians, Americans should be having right now.
Jonathan, I saw a question that you said that people should be talking with Hamas, but the questioner asks, does Hamas want peace and a resolution of the conflict?
Absolutely. I think they want peace. I think they want peace even more than the Israelis want peace. The question is, at what price? What are they willing to do for it? All Israelis want peace. I'm convinced of that. Not just the majority. All Israelis want peace. The question is, what does peace mean to them? Does it mean total surrender by the Palestinians? So Hamas, I know Hamas has been demonized in the West and in Israel, just like the PLO was demonized before they started the negotiations. And it may be a process before Hamas can be brought into the negotiations. But if you want to deal with the Palestinian question, you have to deal with Gaza. If you want to deal with Gaza, you have to deal with Hamas. It's as simple as that. Do we bring them into the conversation? On what conditions? What do they have to do to provide? What do they have to change in their charter, in their rhetoric, in their language, and in their actions to come into the process? There's a whole number of things that we can get involved. But let's get involved with it. Let's bring them into the conversation. We have to. Let's bring Gaza into the conversation. Let's lift the siege of Gaza. It's beyond the need of security. Because actually, the only thing that does go into Gaza these days is weapons. They have no problem getting weapons in. But everything else cannot go in. And everything else cannot go out. Well, agricultural products. What possible security reason is there to control agricultural products going out or coming in? There's just no logic for it other than we want to punish these people. Collective punishment. We want to keep them under very tight control. And you have 2 million people there, they're going to explode. They are definitely going to explode. So let's lift the siege of Gaza. Let's end administrative detentions. Let's loosen up and start allowing normal life in Area C and in other areas of the West Bank. Maybe these battles we can win. Human rights, maybe this battle we can win. And let's leave the issue, I agree with Jessica, that the issue of two state versus one state may be a useless conversation to have right now, but let's be serious. At some point, we will have to have that conversation and let's get ready for it. One other thing I must, I hate to say this, but I must say it. We may get rid of Netanyahu. That does not solve the problem. Our problem is not just Netanyahu. I'm afraid that, you know, when Netanyahu falls, and he will, that when he falls, everybody will have a nice sigh of relief. We got rid of him, and the policies will continue as is. This is my biggest fear, that all the progressives in Israel and in the United States think Netanyahu is the problem, and when we get rid of Netanyahu, peace will come. It will not. The problems are much, much deeper, and they need to be addressed.
One thing that we haven't really referred to in this discussion so far is the normalization deals. what's called the Abraham Accords. And I see a question from Lawrence Jaffe that he understood that the Palestinians feel angry and betrayed that the UAE and Bahrain deals bypass them. But is there any possibility that those deals can be used as a tool to reassert demands for peace, for Palestinian rights? Any role possibly of the Palestinians living in the Gulf states, and also the question of the Arab League and the Arab Peace Initiative? Is there any way that they can be used as levers today?
I think that these deals actually reduce the tools at our disposal. For a long time, we said, make peace with the Palestinians so that you'll have access to the entire Arab world. Netanyahu saying, no, I have access to the entire Arab world. I don't need the Palestinians. And you have the UAE, you have settlers going there. You have deals. Basically, they are arms deals. They have weakened, definitely, the Palestinians. But ultimately, they have not helped the core issue, which is Palestine and Palestinians. Egypt and Jordan, have they used their peace deals to, on behalf of the Palestinians? Sometimes, a little, they have. Will the UAE or Sudan use their influence with Israel to improve the situation for the Palestinians? I doubt it, but maybe they will. But ultimately, it's not these deals that will bring about an end to the conflict or bring about any resolution for Israelis and Palestinians.
Now, I'd like to combine two questions. On the one hand, it's noted that the evangelicals will no longer be calling the cards in Washington. Clearly, they will be out, and J Street will be in. So that's one factor which we should consider. And this leads me to the question of, do you think that the increasingly influential and vocal progressive Democratic legislators can influence the Biden administration in terms of its Israel-Palestine policy?
Yes, so I jump in, and this is the good opportunity to make the point that Israel-Palestine is not foreign policy. I mean, this has been the case for a very long time, but we see more clearly now than ever. Israel-Palestine is domestic policy in the United States, and you have anti-democratic trends in the name of, let's say most clearly, this idea that BDS is inherently anti-Semitic, and then the legislation, both federal and in states across the country, that sanctions on individuals, on organizations, if they are supporting BDS, or, you know, even crazy cases, teachers in Texas that have to sign a statement that they oppose BDS in order to get, you know, funding from the state of Texas. So, I mean, I think these initiatives that have to be rebuked very clearly. I mean, that BDS has taken on, it's like the boogeyman that, God forbid anyone should say, not only that they support BDS, or even if they don't support it, but that they recognize that other people have a right to support it. I mean, that is, a really powerful tool to be silencing speech in the United States. And, that the fight against anti-Semitism in the past 4 years has been hijacked, at a time where you actually have, old-fashioned anti-Semites literally killing Jews in the United States. The main impetus of the fight, the formal administration fight, as well as the Jewish community, is targeting BDS. So, that is not even necessarily crucial for, our interests here in Israel-Palestine. It's crucial for progressives in the United States, for Jews, you know, regardless of their views on Israel, to understand that, you know, we need to, you know, reassert what is the number one priority in terms of the fight against anti-Semitism. It certainly is not fighting against BDS. And there, I think the progressives can pose a useful, you know, there is, of course, there is a process underway within the Democratic Party. And those issues have to be front and center on the agenda, not only for the benefit of us here in Israel-Palestine, for the benefit of the progressive community in the United States.
I see a very interesting question in the question box from Donna Baranski-Walker. What further damage can Trump do before he leaves, and what can we Americans do to prevent this? So this is very timely. Any comments on that?
Jonathan, you want to start?
Yeah, I think that he's capable of doing a lot of damage as he leaves. I don't know if he'll have time for it, because he's very busy with trying to make more money and to create as much havoc internally for the U.S. I don't think he's going to gain. Well, I don't know. If Adelson offers him a few million dollars to do something, no matter what, he will.
Yes, but I don't think it needs to be Trump. I mean, Ambassador Friedman, that has his own agenda, that knows that his days are limited. You know, even now we are seeing, you know, the reports today in the press about new settlement expansion, because they have, you know, 70 days of this blank check to do whatever they want. And then, you know, maybe after that, there will be repercussions. So, you know, for all sorts of reasons, it seems like a very long time until January 20th, right? It's like an eternity. What can happen domestically in the United States, and what can happen here as well? But Donna's second question, you know, the second half of the question, what can we do? And I think, you know, it would be important, you know, if the current Congress could push back, civil society here and there, you know, of course, what have we been able to push back against, you know, throughout these 4 years? It's an uphill battle, but certainly to, you know, keep our eyes on the ball for the next 2 months. It does feel like a particularly dangerous time.
Okay, and now I see a question from David Goodman that I would actually like to respond to first. If the two-state solution is dead, how might we see a fair and just one-state solution? Jonathan, I know you're also working on something in that direction, but first I would like to comment that I don't think that the two-state solution is dead. If you look at the work of Shaul Arieli, which I would recommend, according to his studies, 80% of the settlers live within 5 to 6% of the area next, adjacent to the Green Line, to the 1967 borders. And if you had an agreement which would be based upon a mutually agreed upon land swap of 4 to 5%, you would have 80% of the settlers. The two largest communities which are growing right now are the ultra-Orthodox towns of Beitar Elite and Modi'in Elite. They would be adjacent to the six-day border and would be part of the sovereign state. So that would neutralize the settler problem, and you would just have about 80,000 settlers who would be on the other side of that area, most of whom would want to come back to Israel proper in an exchange return home with compensation. Of course, the one major thing which is lacking is political will on the Israeli side, on the international side, to try to push that forward. But it is still possible. as far as a one-state solution is concerned, the overwhelming majority of the Israelis simply do not want it. And so here I'd like to hear Jonathan explain why you think that may be possible.
The question is not whether they would want it. The question is whether they can be forced or the situation changes, whether they will have to accept it. The majority of whites did not want to end slavery. The majority of slaveholders didn't want to give up slavery. Of course they didn't. Rabin was not able to remove 400 settlers from the heart of Hebron at the height, even after they committed this massacre in the Ibrahimi Mosque. To remove 80,000 settlers today is just almost unthinkable, given the realities of Israel today. The question is, can we change that paradigm? Can we start thinking in different terms than we are now? The paradigm of two states has become a sort of alibi. You don't need to solve the problem of the Palestinians. They have their own parliament. They have their own PA. They have their own institutions. Just, you know, we tweak it a little bit. We give them a little bit more. Two states has become an excuse. AIPAC today believes in a two-state solution. That's true. I met Thomas Dine and I said, what's your position these days? And before I finish my sentence, he says, two states. Two states is a wonderful alibi. It means Israel is not responsible for several million Palestinians who are really under its control. Just like Gaza is wonderful for Israel. They're not our problem anymore. They're the problem of Hamas. They're outside of the discussion. We're not outside of the discussion. We are in the heart of the discussion. And the discussion has to take place. Do we believe in equality? Do we believe in full human rights? Do we believe that we are entitled to whatever Israelis think they are entitled to? Or are we going to insist on a two-tier process for rights, for everything? Is apartheid really acceptable? Or do we believe in equality? These are fundamental issues. I don't know if we have a chance to get into all of them now, but at least on an interim basis, we have to start moving in the right direction, and we haven't been. We haven't been.
Okay, we are actually nearing the end of our time. So perhaps just one observation from both of you about the situation in the United States. We see a tremendously divided society, and when you look at the United States, and I think we all agree that America has a central role to play in international affairs, how do you see the future of America in the direction that it is going today?
You want to start?
I will start. I think, you know, people have always thought that the solution comes from America. I think if America can stay out of the situation, it will be wonderful. Because they have been part of the problem so far. They have been part of the problem in enabling Israel, not only militarily, not only economically, not only with trade, not only diplomatically, but also in terms of protecting them from international law. Protecting them from world opinion, protecting them from the reality of having to deal with other countries in the Middle East. The U.S. has been the umbrella protecting Israeli privilege. So if there's any way we can take that umbrella away, I think Israelis will be forced to deal with Palestinians and to deal with the Arab world in a way that they never have had to until this point. Yes, the United States is crucial, but it's crucial as part of the problem. I hope at some time it will be part of the solution, but so far it's only been part of the problem.
Okay, so Jessica, your thoughts?
Yes, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question, you know, and sometimes when I meet human rights activists from conflicts that nobody has ever heard of, you know, places, and I think, is it more intractable, the places where you don't have everyone trying to help them broker a peace, as opposed to our conflict, that everyone is involved in trying to help us, you know, has it been helpful or not helpful? But actually, I would use my 1 minute, you know, to just respond again to this issue of the, you know, two state, one state argument, to, you know, implore that we not go there in terms of how we are using our energies in terms of the direction of the Biden administration. There is so much that can be done right now, that Israel, you know, has to stop arresting Palestinian teenage boys in the middle of the night. They can do that right away. Israel has to dismantle the separation barrier. They can do that unilaterally, the places where the barrier is built inside the West Bank. You know, Israel has to stop demolishing Palestinian houses. Just stop. It doesn't matter whether Hamas is a partner for peace. It doesn't matter whether, you know, we can dismantle settlements, whether the PA, you know, can negotiate. You know, all of these things that are unilateral Israeli responsibilities, 100% within Israel's ability to just respect human rights right now. I would say that that should really be the conversation going forward about where the Biden administration should be investing the very limited resources it's going to be investing in terms of Israel-Palestine.
Okay, I see that we are nearing the end of our time here. So I'd like to thank both the panelists and the audience. And we will be leaving soon. I would only wish that Trump would understand that he should be leaving soon as well. And I pass it over back to Ron Skolnick for final comments.
Thank you, Hillel. And thank you, Jessica Montell, Jonathan Kutab, Hillel Shanker, for a really important, really challenging conversation we're about to enter, some very interesting times. Thanks go out also to my partners, Progressive Israel colleagues, for helping to make this webinar happen, and to all of you. A lot of people showed up for the conversations. They were really delighted, and we hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to learn more about Partners for Progressive Israel's programming, not just this webinar series, but other programs, again, the website is progressiveisrael.org. And while you're there, please take a poke around, and delighted if you could make a contribution so that we can keep this programming free and ongoing. So thanks again, everyone. Stay safe, mask up, and hope to see you next time.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.